How's it going, everybody? Hope you're having a good Sunday. Thanks for tuning in to the new episode of the Phoenix MMA and Fitness Podcast. So this episode, I'm actually really excited to do this episode. We've had a lot of talk about this this week in the gym with our students and everybody, pro fighters, UFC fighters, UFC commentators. This is a controversial decision in the media and the people over the fight last weekend. UFC 297, Dricus du Plessis versus Sean Strickland. So this episode, Dricus du Plessis versus Sean Strickland. Why did the judges give it to du Plessis? So my goal in this is to explain a bit about UFC judging or MMA judging in general, so that, you know, there are going to sometimes be really, really bad decisions, but these will give you some heuristic rules that you can, if you really want to score round by round, and you really want to score fights where it can help you as you're watching the fights, be able to predict what the judges, how they're going to score it. So just so you know, if you want to fully enjoy MMA, you know, you might not want to do this because it's going to turn it into work and turn it into a job. Most fans watch UFC fights like a fan, and they're not watching it like a judge. So, you know, if you're a nerd and you like to do it, or you just like to be right or correct about things and understand, what's going on in the sport, then, you know, I enjoy it. But you know, I've been in the game for 22 years now. So, I watched it as a fan for probably the first 3 to 5 years, and I would get my heart broken over and over and over because I was, judging fights with my heart and judging fights with bias. I got tired of getting my heart broken. I got tired of being wrong too on, fight predictions and, judges' scorecards. This is not saying that, you know, the judges always get it right. They definitely do not. But when you understand how the judges score fights, it will help you understand some decisions, and it'll help you understand when you're watching a fight, you can score it. I like to score fights round by round. It's a lot of fun. There are going to be some bad robberies. This reminds me of when I was with the sheriff's office. There would be sometimes YouTube videos that would pop up, or they'd be in the news, of an officer, and the general public, they have zero legal training. They have zero use of force training. They're completely ignorant of the law and law enforcement. And oftentimes, and also the clips will be shortened, so you don't get to see the full context of what's going on or understand what was the nature of the call. And, you know, the vast majority of the time on those, there are some incidents where, you know, being a police officer, or when I was, officers will speak to each other and say, you know, that was a bad one. And honestly, it's something that law enforcement does constantly critiques, just like a sports team, when there's a mistake or a loss, we'll go back and look at those where it was a mistake, figure out how that happened, so that you can make it not happen again. But in my experience, the general public has no idea about laws. They have no idea about criminal charges. Sometimes they'll be calling for a first-degree murder, and they don't even know what a first-degree murder, like what things have to line up for it to be considered that. And they don't understand that if you charge somebody with a crime and it doesn't line up properly, that's a way that somebody could get off on a crime just by judging incorrectly. But usually people who have the least amount of experience, least amount of training, least amount of knowledge are the loudest about things. And it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect, and it's just it's basically a U, and it's everybody susceptible to it, myself included. When we're a beginner in a subject and we have a small amount of knowledge or experience in a subject, that's when we are extremely confident, because we don't know what we don't know. And the it looks like a U, you know, where it starts pretty high. You could say like a 10 out of 10 confidence on the subject when you first step in. And just about every guy runs into this when they come into the gym. 10 out of 10, like, I know how to fight. I know what's going on. And then the more that you train and the more that you just get shown that you don't know what you're doing, that dips like a U. It goes down significantly to where even sometimes your confidence can drop significantly. And a lot of people will quit training because they don't like that. People do it with everything too. Once they actually try to go into nuance and education on a subject, lots of people, their eyes will gloss over. I'd say the majority of people, their eyes gloss over it, lose their attention span, and they're on to a new subject. But if you can stick with it, if it's something that you actually like, if you can stick with it and study more, practice more, train more, compete more, you will gain more knowledge. And then it's just like a U on the opposite side of that, then your confidence starts to then increase again. So it's pretty funny. It's a funny thing that an expert in a field and a beginner in a field, the beginner will have the same amount of confidence on a subject matter as the expert, but with absolutely no reason to have that level of confidence. And sometimes, I'd say there's a lot of beginners that have far more confidence than experts, because at an expert level, you've put in over 10,000 hours, 10 years of experience on doing a subject. You have seen so many variables, and you've been wrong so many times. You've had to eat crow so many times that you are the expert can be less loud or matter of fact in a subject than the beginner. So, but welcome to, you know, if you ever watch a fight at a sports bar or a sport, a game or anything, and the guy who is the most loud and obnoxious and being an idiot, doesn't even understand the rules, never played college football or professional football, or, you know, never even fought amateur, but is never fought amateur, maybe has never trained, and believes that they know exactly how a fight should be scored or how they are scored. So, but we're susceptible to it with everything. I've had a bunch of things that I look back on, it's statements I've made that were cringe because I was just so ignorant to something. So try to be quiet when I'm ignorant to something, and try to listen to experts, people with more experience than me. First thing we'll go into, if you think that Strickland won the fight last weekend, you're not stupid. You're not an idiot. Obviously it was a split decision, and there's a lot of UFC fighters, that have seen it for Duplessis, and there are UFC fighters, fight analysts, journalists that have seen it for Strickland as well. A couple examples, Hamzat Chimaev said he had it 50-50, but he edged it for Strickland. Luke Thomas, who is a trusted MMA journalist, he had it initially when he watched it live for Duplessis. He said when he rewatched it, he had it for Strickland. Henry Cejudo, Olympic gold medalist in wrestling, UFC champion, had it clearly for Duplessis. Chael Sonnen, I'm sure everybody listening to this knows who Chael Sonnen is. Chael Sonnen had it for Duplessis. Sean O'Malley, UFC champion, had it for Duplessis. Dan Hardy, who fought George St. Pierre for the belt, now I'm getting old, back in the day, he had it. He said initially when he watched it, he had it initially for Strickland, and then when he watched the fight the following day two more times, he had it for Duplessis. Michael Bisping, UFC champion, had it for Duplessis. Demetrius Johnson, one of the greatest MMA fighters of all time, had it for Duplessis. And Firas Ahavi, George St. Pierre's coach, one of the best MMA coaches in the game, had it for Duplessis, but he thought it was a close fight as well. So some of those people I mentioned had it clearly for Duplessis. Some of the fighters, some of the people I mentioned said that it was very close, but had it for Strickland. But this episode, what I've noticed in the gym immediately after the fight was the vast majority of our students had it for Strickland, and also I'm talking about the fans on the internet and stuff, and that's not a good poll to call from, because on the internet everybody trolls and is being louder than life just for amusement or to get under people's skin and things. We're saying that Duplessis was robbed, Strickland was robbed. So if you think that Strickland was robbed, like it wouldn't have surprised me at the end of the fight when I was watching it live, if either person would have got the decision, it wouldn't have surprised me. Now, I predicted while I was watching the fight, I watched it out of Buffalo Wild Wings. I drank two beers during this, so this does affect my judgment, but I drank two beers watching it in Buffalo Wild Wings, so I couldn't hear the commentary. I'm watching at a screen from a table, but I gave it to Duplessis. So, the reason why I gave it for Duplessis is I know how the UFC, how judges score, because I have 22 years experience in combat sports. I have fought amateur, I've fought professional, both in MMA. I have refereed amateur MMA fights, and I have also refereed amateur MMA, and I've judged amateur MMA. So I know I've been the fighter in the cage, I've been the referee in the cage, and I've been the judge on the side of the cage as well. So all three of those perspectives. And I was also the fan, like I said, early on, where I watched fights as a fan, with my heart. So yeah, just going to give my perspective the details that I've learned from my experience on how judges score MMA fights, UFC fights. If you think that Strickland was absolutely robbed, here's your sign that you could be a casual. What is a casual? Casuals are, it's like a slang or a slur towards people that they don't train. Maybe they train, but they have less than 5 years experience. They've never had an amateur MMA fight. They've definitely never had a professional MMA fight. But most casuals are just casual fans that don't train, don't compete. They've never fought. Casual fans, they really don't keep up with the sport. They might not be able to explain the difference from an omoplata to a K-guard or a check hook versus a left hook, check hook versus a lead hook. They might be able to not explain to you the differences in the different styles of front kicks. They just can't give you any real details, and they're just casual. They bounce from sport to sport to sport. It just depends on the day. And, whatever season it is, if it's football season, it's football season. If it's basketball season, it's basketball. If it's a really big UFC fight, something with a really big name value, then they're watching that, but they're not watching the fight nights. They definitely don't go to local MMA shows, or they've definitely never fought. And, when the Olympics is around, they're all about the Olympics. And when the World Cup's is around, they're all about soccer. So, that would be the casuals. Let's see. First thing we need to go over, when you're watching a fight, if you want to watch it like a judge, or you want to be able to predict what the judges are seeing, you have to understand that you have a natural bias. Chael Sonnen has a video that he did earlier this week. It's on YouTube, on his channel. I'd recommend listening to it, because he has some good information on that video. But he goes over, first thing he goes over is bias, and he announces his immediate bias. His bias is that he has a strong bias for Sean Strickland. He says Sean Strickland is his guy, and it's because he saw Strickland when he was young and broke, and he's just in that grind mode. So, and Sean and Chael Sonnen worked with him, trained with him, sparred with him. So whenever you train, you spar, you work with somebody for years, it's going to be impossible not to have a bias. So Chael at least mentions that. People that say they have no bias at all are just, not self-aware. I'd say they're not self-aware, or they truly don't care about the fight. But if you care about the fight, you're going to have a bias that you're looking for. And Chael mentions that in his video, and he says, "Hey, I have a bias for Strickland, but I still had Duplessis winning the fight." And he also mentioned that video that he's giving scores the way that he knows judges score UFC fights. So that your natural bias is going to be very difficult to overcome, because what you're going to do is you are, everything that your fighter does that they do well is going to be weighted heavier in your mind. It could be that the opponent shoots a double leg and your fighter sprawls on him right away and stands up. And you're like, oh, yeah, he won that grappling exchange. He didn't win the grappling exchange. If you shoot and then they sprawl and they stand up, he didn't win the grappling exchange. You have to understand that they score off of effort and who's initiating attack. So if you only – if fighter A shoots on fighter B sprawls and then they stand and then stands back up, fighter A is still winning with the judges because they are initiating the attack. Now, if fighter B was in the same scenario, was to sprawl on that double leg, hit a go-behind, and then get on top, throw a couple punches, and then say fighter A stands back up, then the judges could see that for fighter B, because fighter A took the initiative and attacked. Fighter B defended that that initial attack and then re-attacked. So then could have not only defending, but also taking back the initiative. So this is really important when it comes to scoring. I think a lot of fans don't realize that defense is not rewarded. Defense or escapes is not rewarded. This is a really common thing that I hear where if somebody is going for a submission, and they get close to the submission, but the person escapes it. Or somebody's going for a takedown, and the person defends the takedowns. Or if somebody throws 15, 20 shots, but the opponent does high guard, brings their hands up, and they survive it. They defend. They block the majority of the punches. Defense is not rewarded when it comes to actual scoring. Think of defenses as your taxes. You don't get a reward for paying your taxes. You just have to do it. If you don't pay your taxes, the IRS comes after you. So defense is not rewarded. You have to do it, because if not, the fighter is going to finish the fight via submission during that, or that flurry of strikes they're doing. Or if it's a takedown, they're going to get on top and have top position riding time, and then they're going to do damage to you. So if you're going to actually score fights, switch your filter from your fighter. Are they not being able to do anything to him because he's defending everything? That is a sure way to lose a decision. And this could be a decision in a jiu-jitsu match, or it could be especially ADCC. This could be a way to lose a decision in a jiu-jitsu match, grappling match, or it could be a way that you lose a decision in an MMA fight. Does not mean that you should just run forward and just bear forward, just blitzkrieg. That's not smart either, okay? What I predicted, I actually thought that Sean Strickland, striking-wise, was going to be able to really pick Du Plessis apart. I thought that Dan Hardy's prediction was similar to mine. He predicted that Sean Strickland was going to be pressuring, not rushing, but pressuring and marching forward, and was going to smother him with smart pressure, precise strikes, and wear him down conditionally from smothering him with the pressure, precise strikes, and eventually hurt him. And Du Plessis was going to look like he was really, like, backing away, going to be in a lot of trouble round 4 and 5. But that didn't happen. I was surprised that Strickland was backing away the entire fight. Hindsight, looking back at it, I think that Strickland's strategy might have been to work behind the jab, work behind his front kick, take precise shots, and then as Du Plessis begins to fatigue because he throws a lot of power strikes, then start taking the initiative, and maybe round 3, 4, 5. And with that, when we were watching it before Wild Wings, going into round 4, I said to Hunter and Sheldon, we were watching the fight, I said, if Strickland doesn't take the initiative, if he doesn't start trying to throw more power strikes and start not just backing away, if he doesn't start with some type of forward pressure, I think he's going to coast to losing his title. That's what happens. So, let's see, natural bias, like, what are ways that you can do it first, or how can you overcome your natural bias? First, you need to realize that you have one. you can rewatch the fight with no commentary, no stats available. It's going to be tough because you get the stats when you're watching the fight there, but don't pay attention to the stats. Don't turn on commentary. Just quiet. And watch the fighter that you don't like. Watch the fighter you don't like, and don't watch the fighter that you do like. Because when you have the bias, again, what you're doing is you're paying attention to everything that the fighter that you like does, and everything, whether it's a jab or it could be a low kick, you are scoring it very, very heavy. And if the fighter that you don't like takes the fighter that you do like down, and then your fighter stands right back up, you're like, okay, cool, he did nothing with the takedown. But we'll go into the judging criteria just a second. And the bias is... The bias is so strong. Like my first, these little bias psychological tricks with people, even for local MMA, amateur and professional local MMA, there are little tricks. So like the my coach, my first MMA coach, Ed Clay, he would have all of his fighters, all of us, he would make us wear white shorts. And the reason why he would make us white shorts is he had read a study that the white shorts naturally attract the eye of the judges, kind of like a highlighter marker. And again, the judges, especially in a local show, they don't know either one of you. There's a good chance they don't know either one of you. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But if they don't know either one of you, the white shorts are enough to draw the eye. You got to think you're in a dark room. You're in a dark room. The cage is elevated or illuminated, but you're in a dark room, and the white shorts. Something as small as that can cause the judges to pay attention to you more, and then you start using that that little bias or attention trick where they're noticing everything that you're doing. So, but like I said, it can turn into a job. It's not fun to watch a fight with no commentary on and nobody around you. Again, you're turning into a job, but you have to understand that's the judge's perspective. They're not getting to hear the commentary, and they're not seeing the stats, and they're supposed to be impartial. Again, nobody's completely impartial, or that they don't have bias, but it is their job, and to some degree they could get in trouble or lose their job if it comes out that they're friends with so and so. And I know that this is not a perfect system. I used to work bartender at a fine dining restaurant. It was right across from Bridgestone Arena, and I remember seeing a couple of the Preds players that took two of the referees out. It was the day before the game too. Day before the game, they took them out to like $1,000 dinner. That one, there's corruption and everything. So, let's see. All right. Yeah. So we got to understand the judge's perspective. How are the judges looking at the fight? Who, what, when, where, how? Let's go through it. Where are the judges seated? Okay. There's three judges. They're seated on the outside where you see the ring girls walking around with the round cards in between rounds. The judges are sitting there. You'll see Dana White there. Sometimes you'll see Donald Trump beside Dana White. And then the corners are there as well, the coaches. And then there's a whole bunch of other people. It's camera crew, production staff. But the state athletic director that's over at the doctor. And the judges have three different positions separated from each other. The judges also aren't speaking in between rounds. They're not collaborating and talking about who fought what. They're seated three different positions around. They're seated at that table where they're looking. Their perspective is they're looking up. The fighters are elevated above them, and they have a 7-inch monitor. But again, they're not listening to the commentary, and they're not getting the fight stats. So I don't know how much they're looking at the monitor versus how much they're looking at the live event. But for local MMA, amateur and pro, if it's not the UFC, the judges are looking. They are looking straight up. So their vision can be obstructed by the cage. It can also be obstructed by the post. They have the noise of the crowd as well. But you do have as a judge, you do have the best seat in the house. So you do get to actually hear strikes when they land, and that's going to come into when it comes to strikes versus what's a power strikes versus just a strike. And this is one of my frustrations I have with the UFC metrics, the stats that they give out. I wish they would give more accurate stats than they do. So we'll go into that in just a second. So so just think, they have fence posts, they have the crowd, they're also there so they can hear strikes in their land as well, better than we can hear when our friends are talking to us or we're cheering and stuff, and you know, there's background noise. But you actually get to hear, if somebody throws a switch kick right on the liver, you get to actually hear, and you can feel it sometimes. You can feel it, and you can, the sweat splatters on your face, and also you can see the fighter's reactions much better because you're so close. You can see their face, you can see the pain in the face, you can see the legs start to spasm or the body start to spasm. You can see a lot more details when you're cage side like that. Let's see. Okay. Where they're seated affects it. Can they hear commentary? Already answered that. No, they can't hear that. They're not listening to the commentary because they are supposed to look at it from their perspective, and they're supposed to be as objective as possible. It's not. Judging is subjective. It's not a clear black and white. It's not binary. But they're not, they're supposed to not be swayed by commentary, or also this is why they're not talking to each other in between. They don't even have time to talk to each other in between rounds. It's 5 5-minute rounds with 1 minute rest. The judges have scorecards that they have to do, a 10-point must system, 10 points to the winner, and then nine or less to the loser. And they're watching the fight, and as they're watching the fight, they are, once that round is over, they then have to give their score. I think it's only a minute in between rounds. They have 60 seconds to put their score on their score sheet. So they have to make the decision pretty quickly. Do they get fight stats? No, they're not getting fight stats. And then what's the judging criteria? Okay, so this is really when it comes down to it. And you can go on and you can Google the Unified MMA rules, and it's free, it's available to the public. It's a 10-page PDF form. And you could, honestly, you could read that 10-page rules form, and you could still feel confused by it. Or you could still read that and think you understand it and not understand it. So I'll go into the broad strokes or your heuristic rules that you want to use, or something that'll help you with judges when they're scoring. So for the United rules, plan A is effective striking and grappling. So effective striking, let's go into that first, okay? So effective striking, what does that mean? What does effective striking mean? Okay, or what effective striking, not significant strikes. Significant strikes, if you see the metrics that pop up, are defined as a strike at distance that lands, and then power strikes that land in the clinch or in the ground position. Okay, so if you take somebody down, you're in their closed guard, and you're just throwing like little rabid like punches to the body and the head, or like little rabid punches, that's not a way that you can just rack up, you know, a whole bunch of strikes for what they're scoring for. That's significant strikes. This is where it can confuse you. Okay, so you see the fight stats, and when you see the fight stats, Sean Strickland total, like when I watched the fight, I actually thought that Duplessis, when I watched it live, I thought Duplessis had thrown more strikes, more volume. Okay, at the end of the fight, I was incorrect. He had not. It was just my perspective at Buffalo Wild Wings that Duplessis had thrown more strikes. Why did I think that Duplessis had thrown more strikes? It's because of his forward pressure. It was because of his varied attack. It's harder to keep up with it when you're watching it live and your opponent's doing jab, cross, inside low kick, outside low kick, kick to the body, head kick. So it makes the person look very, very busy, even if they're, you know, the stats don't show this. Okay, so Strickland had 419 total strikes that he did. Out of those 419 total strikes, only 11 of them were not considered significant strikes. Again, if they're not considered significant strikes for the stats, it's little punches that in the clinch that don't that aren't going to affect much or groundwork, the ground position. But he had more significant strikes that he landed, and he attempted more overall strikes. But out of his 419, only 11 we can take away as significant strikes. So he had far more significant strikes when it comes to the fight stats. But when you rewatch the fight, I just rewatched it, the vast majority of Sean Strickland's strikes are jabs. So that's how he can rack up a high strike count, overall strike count and significant strike count. Because not the unified rule set, the metrics that the UFC has given you classify a jab as a significant strike. So when you see those stats pop up, the significant strike count, one person could throw five jabs and the other person could throw a right hook. Okay, and this is the part that fans don't realize when it comes to the difference between fans and judging. So when you see the stats and where stats can lie to you, somebody could throw five jabs and the other person throws one right hook or one big lead hook, overhand, or a kick to the body or a head kick. Okay, those five jabs, that one power shot can overrule those five jabs. Okay, when it comes to effective striking from the judges' criteria, they're looking for damaging blows. Okay, so this is where it can get difficult. The difference between the stats and the judging. Okay, and this is what I think lost the fight for Sean Strickland. His jab was amazing. He closed Duplessis' eye, and he was really, really busy with the jab. And that is actually a good way to fight. This is a smart thing to do. Work behind your jab. Work behind set-up low kicks where there's not a lot of power on them. They're long low kicks, even front kicks that don't have a bunch of power on them. But you have to understand, for the judges, if that jab or those set-up low kicks don't wobble your opponent, rock your opponent, like where it actually stuns them, if they throw a single overhand or a big head kick and it connects, that is going to weigh heavier in the judges' scoring than your five jabs that you threw, or potentially your 10 jabs that you threw. So this is where the stats can mess up. Boxing, I think, does a better job of this. If you watch a boxing bout, CompuBox will give you the stats. They give you the stats very similar way, but the difference is they separate the jab from power punches. So easy way, just you have jab, and the power punches are your cross, your lead hook, your rear hook, your lead uppercut, rear uppercut. So they separate the two so that you can see the difference. The jab does still affect the fight to a great degree, but think of jabs and light low kicks as setups. So when the judges, and you can win a boxing bout with a jab. You can win a 12-round decision with a jab, circling, moving, making sure that you're not get hit and you outpoint your opponent. This is one of the things that fans and everybody gets frustrated with boxing, is that you can win that fight with a jab when it comes to boxing. If you feel like when you watched Francis Ngannou versus Tyson Fury, you might have thought, hey, Fury hurt Tyson Fury way more, but if you go look at the CompuBox stats, Tyson Fury landed significantly more strikes, and lots of those were off the jab. But that's where, if you're looking at it from like an MMA judge perspective, you may be like, hey, you know, Francis hurt Tyson a couple times, if not two, not three times in that fight. You might have judged that with an MMA perspective. When I watched the fight, Francis surprised me how much he did to Tyson. He did much better than I expected. But with the decision, I knew that Tyson Fury was going to get the decision because of the difference between how boxing is scored versus MMA. So understand that Sean, the vast majority of his strikes, his significant strikes and overall strikes on the metrics that the UFC shows you on the screen, were higher than Duplessis. But Duplessis threw more power strikes and landed more power strikes. If you want proof of this, you can go to it's a video on YouTube. The channel is called The Weasel, and it's it's a funny YouTube channel name, but The Weasel. And you can see he breaks down round two and round four, I believe, the two controversial rounds in the fight. And what he breaks down is the strikes, and he only, he just isolates the striking portion, and he isolates every single exchange in round two and round four between Duplessis and Strickland. And then he classifies the strikes into light, medium, heavy. And when you see, like, round two is a controversial round, Strickland had landed more light strikes, significantly more light strikes, but Duplessis landed significantly more medium strikes. So that you have to understand, that's what judges are looking for. And that's the reason why I thought that if round four, round five, if Strickland didn't take the initiative and really start throwing power strikes, punches and kicks, knees, elbows, if he didn't start throwing power strikes, Duplessis was going to look busy enough to take the belt from him, and take the belt too. This is another thing I have to go over, that Dana White says it, and people say it all the time, and I think it's funny because a lot of people that say facts don't care about your feelings will then tout a feeling thing whenever they choose to. So a lot of people say this, and I used to say it too, but then I just had to realize, like, that's not a fight metric. But the adage of you have to beat the champ to become the champion, or you have to take the belt, that's not a fight metric. Fights aren't measured off that. That's just a feeling. That's just a feeling. That's just an opinion. But you can't have a sport that's based off that. What would happen is you would have a King of the Hill thing where the champions, you would, with that, champions could potentially coast and just fight in a very defensive manner, and it's at the highest level, they're so evenly matched, it's going to be really hard for somebody to dominate the other person when they're very well matched, everything from skill to athleticism. But again, that's not a metric like the people are saying it, but that is not how fights are scored. That's just a feeling. I get if it's just an opinion, like I feel like it, I just say I feel like it should be that way, but it's not. They don't score it that way. So if you're actually trying to talk about robberies or who should have won a decision, you have to delete that. You have to omit that, because that's not a factor that's thrown into judging or scoring. So then grappling, effective grappling was the other part of plan A on the there's plan A, B, and C for the judging criteria for the unified rules. Effective grappling, that's going to be everything from takedowns to ride time, control, dominant positions, near submissions. In this fight, they're really the only grappling there was were takedowns from Duplessis. And Duplessis had 6 out of 11 takedowns. Strickland had 0 for 0. Okay, so remember what I said about even if you go for a takedown and they defend it and they stand back up, the judges are seeing that as the person who's initiating the takedowns is the person who's going for the takedowns is still getting the nod there. Now, if Strickland would have wobbled Duplessis really well in any of those rounds, or if he would have dropped him, like say he dropped him and Duplessis stands right back up, he would have won that round easy. The judges would have weighed that very heavy. It's as a judge, this happens all the time where, and this is the easiest way I could boil down rounds. Whenever the striking looks close, like neither person gets really, really hurt in the fight, what they're looking for oftentimes is who is throwing the harder power shots, who is driving forward, and then if the only grappling there is takedowns, and Duplessis scores 6 of 11 takedowns, and Sean Strickland got 0 of 0 attempts, the judges are then, you know, think each round, they're saying, hey, who's having more effective striking? Who's throwing the harder shots? Who's landing more power shots? Okay, over, and its immediate effect is weighed heavier than cumulative effect. Who's throwing more power shots? Who's landing more power shots? And then who is throwing or attempting more takedowns or grappling exchanges, and who is successfully landing those grappling exchanges? And each round, that's plan A. That's the first thing that they're looking at, and that's their first filter they're looking at. Plan B, in the rules, effective aggressiveness, that one, the best translation I could give for effective aggressiveness would be, pressure, taking initiative, and again Power Strikes, because they're who's in Pride, it used to be they would judge heavily whoever's trying to finish the fight. So if you're throwing in a big overhand, even if it misses, the judges are seeing that as, you know, that fighter's trying to finish the fight right there. It's not stupid or a bad strategy to work behind your jab and move side to side. That's actually really smart. Smart to do, especially when you have a power striker. It's probably why Strickland didn't march him down, because he didn't want to run into Duplessis. Can be unpredictable, and he throws majority power shots. So if you step into that guy, you maybe eat something. It would be a smart way to fight like a Yoel Romero as well. But in MMA, if you work behind your jab and you back away, you can give up that round. Even if, you know, they don't drop you, if they're landing power shots and you're still not getting dropped, you almost get finished, the judges are still seeing that as the effective aggressiveness. Or the guy could go for 10 takedowns on your row and you stuff all 10 takedowns. That's still him. The aggressiveness, it maybe wasn't effective, but he's still getting the nod on attempting. He's bringing the fight to the opponent. Plan C, control the fighting area. And a lot of times people say that is octagon control. That's whoever has the center of the cage, whoever has the center of the ring, whoever doesn't have their back to the fence, the ropes. During sparring on Thursdays, lots of times I'll tell people, when you get cornered, make sure you circle left, circle right, go back to the center. Don't get cornered. When you get cornered, even if you're blocking and slipping everything, it's, again, boxing, like Floyd Mayweather made a career over this. Pernell Whitaker, one of my favorite boxers of all time, could be in the corner and you could throw 10, 20 punches and he would slip every single one. That does actually get scored. That goes into the effect for boxing. The sweet science, they will actually, that nods the judges. But in the UFC, when you're cornered and your back is there, if they throw 10, 20 strikes, even if nothing really hurts you, they're still looking at that, and that's edging them in the other guy's favor. So we don't want to fight with our back on the cage, even when you're not being clinched, push up against the cage. We don't want our back there. You want to circle to the center. And if you can't circle left or right to the center, another good option I suggest is if somebody is pressuring like that, clinch, then circle so that your back is to the center. So now that their back is to the cage, and then lots of times they'll disengage, but then again, you want to take the center. You also have more options when you're in the center. You can move forward, right, left, and backwards. But when your back is to the cage or ropes, you've taken away that backward option, and your movement left and right's also compromised. Let's see. Okay. Tips for how to steal the round. Knowing that this is going over the scoring criteria, judges are favoring power strikes, kicks to the body, kicks to the head, every punch except for jabs, overhands, crosses, lead hook, rear hook, uppercut, knee, elbow, if you're pro. Ways that you can steal the round. If it's a close round, the first thing I'll say is that win the last 30% of the round. If it's amateur, you know, it's the last minute. If it's professional, the last 2 minutes. When it's a closely contested round and the judges can't see it, you know, to them it looks equal for the first 3 minutes or the first 2 minutes for amateur. For the first 70% of the round, if it's pretty equal and you and your opponent, you're pretty evenly matched, you're going back and forth. You want to increase your volume the last 30% of the round. And that's the volume of power strikes and the volume of grappling exchanges. It could be takedowns, or it could be whether you're going for submission or you're pushing hard to pass the guard to get to a dominant position. Or say you are in mount the last minute of the round, increase your volume, your strikes, just to solidify it. I've judged a lot of fights and I've talked to a lot of judges where it is, from their perspective, sitting cage side, the fight is really, really close. And they're in the last minute of the round, or the last 2 minutes of the round, they're internally saying, come on guys, give me something, give me something. It is razor close right now. Give me something. Okay. So, put pressure on your opponent, power strikes, a takedown. That is a way that you can seal a round. Greg Jackson used to, that was one of the strategies they would do, is go for a takedown in the last minute, last minute, 2 minutes. And people say, hey, the takedown, they don't do anything with it. If you get a takedown, they don't do anything with it. Think they're scoring the striking and grappling of each round. If the only exchange grappling-wise is in the last minute or 2 minutes, you get a takedown and there was no other grappling in the round, they have to give it to that person. And think, if the striking was even, and now they're like, okay, well, how was the grappling? Well, the only thing that happened was a takedown. This guy got the takedown, got on top. In that scenario or used earlier, the striking is even. Guy goes for a takedown or shoots a double leg. When the other guy shoots double leg, he sprawls. Instead of just standing up and circling, backing away again, instead he hits a go-behind, gets on top. The guy now has to, like, fight the hands and stand up, or he has to Granby roll and stand up. That's where the judges can still look at it. It's like, okay, that guy shot on you, but you reattacked with the grappling. You won that grappling exchange, and you took the initiative. That guy had to now start retreating by standing up, fighting the hands, or doing a Granby roll, you know, to clear the position. But win the last 30% of the round. It's good rule of thumb always, but especially when it's a close round. And this also will play into jiu-jitsu matches as well. If you, anytime that there's going to be a judge decision rendered, so the tournament we did over the weekend, if there was no score, they would do a 2-minute overtime round, whoever's first to score. But then after that 2-minute overtime round, the referee is going to give a decision. The referee is looking for, if there's no score, like neither person lands any type of thing that would score, it's whoever is initiating. So if it's in an overtime, you want to get more initiations. It could be that you go for, in that overtime period, you go for 5 takedown attempts and your opponent defends all 5 of them. But the ref is looking for that. Who is pressing the action? Not who's stuffing it or blocking the takedowns. Who is initiating the action? And you could do the opposite on bottom. You can that overtime round, you could pull guard for jiu-jitsu. You could pull guard and initiate sweeps and submissions. And the guy on top, even though he's on top, because he's having to defend your sweeps and have to defend your submissions, the referee will give you the decision because even though you're on bottom, you are initiating the attack, sweep and submissions. Next one. Yeah, just another reminder is the fights are not judged in their entirety. That would be Pride Rules. So if you go back and watch Pride Rules, one of the things, especially when I first started training, I really preferred the Pride Rules, but they judge the fight not round by round. Not round by round, each round, but they judge the fight in its entirety. I also like that they had a 10-minute first round, gave more time to see what the fight looked like. 5-minute rounds are pretty short, but yeah, Pride would judge it in its entirety, and Pride would really punish you if you weren't trying to win the fight. I believe it was Ricardo Arona versus Vanderlei Silva in a title fight where Arona would take him down every round, but he would do what was called lay and pray. Well, it was very popular in the UFC. Matthews won a ton of fights this way. Our wrestlers in the UFC won a ton of fights this way in the early UFC days, just getting takedowns and just standing in the closed guard and, you know, throwing shots to the body and the head, but not advancing position and not getting close to an actual finish on the fight. But Pride, if you're on your feet and you're trying to knock your opponent out the entire time and they just keep taking you down and they're not advancing position and they're just doing the lay and pray strategy, then they would actually give it to the other person who was trying to finish the fight. If they were going for strikes on the feet and they were trying to submit even though they're on bottom, that was a stark difference between the UFC scoring and Pride scoring when they were both around. I actually preferred the Pride scoring criteria. It made for more exciting fights where people were going for finishes. ADCC, there would also be a contrast between ADCC scoring versus the IBJJF scoring. ADCC scoring is very similar to that, where they give initiations. If there's a judgment, they give initiations or they give points. It's invisible points, they're not actual points. They're given initiation points for whoever starts the attack. A match, Mo Jassim, it's on YouTube, you can go watch it. He gives a breakdown of how Nick Rodriguez beat Cyborg. And how that judge's decision. Once you watch the video, it explains it where a lot of people were mad coming from the IBJJF perspective because Cyborg went for submissions and got close to submissions. In the IBJJF, you get advantages if you do a close submission. ADCC doesn't give you advantages. But the explanation from the Mo Jassim, the ADCC president or organizer, when he explained the rules, he said that Cyborg's arm bars were only there because Nicky Rod was initiating guard passes. It wasn't that Cyborg was on bottom, closing the distance and shooting up arm bars. He was more doing counter attacks. When Nicky Rod would attempt to take a guard pass, then Cyborg would go for his near arm bar that he got close on. So that's that would be the grappling equivalent of kind of how the UFC, how the judges lots of times will judge it. It's not perfect. I'm not even saying I agree with it. It's you, if you want to be able to predict these or understand how the judges are, you want to deal with what is, not what you think ought to be. Is not ought. That's just so that you can, so that you'll be, you know, whatever, less, you'll at least, you might not like it, but you'll still at least, you'll understand. You won't be blindsided by these decisions. Oh yeah, and a student mentioned, and I couldn't recall this, I just rewatched this fight as well, but mentioned Peter Yan versus Sean O'Malley, their fight, and I rewatched that fight as well, saying that that was the same fight, but just they gave it to Sean O'Malley. But if you rewatch that fight, they are completely different. Sean O'Malley versus Peter Yan versus compared to Du Plessis versus Strickland. Strickland, all five rounds, is backing away, and he's getting taken down. He goes for no takedowns. Majority of his shots are the jab. In the first couple, in the early rounds, he throws the front kick, but in the later rounds, it's majority jab, and then there are some other strikes that are sprinkled in there. But the Peter Yan versus Sean O'Malley first, that was a split decision also, so that's, you know, the judges were split on that. And when I watched it, I could see how either guy could be given that fight. I could see the argument for either person, and that's one of the tough things when it's a really close fight. But round two and round three, Sean O'Malley almost finishes, like really, really rocks Peter Yan. Peter Yan also rocks Sean O'Malley in round two. But the amount that Sean O'Malley hurts Peter Yan in round two and round three, and the amount that Peter Yan hurts Sean O'Malley in round two, that never happened in the Du Plessis versus Strickland fight. They never had that amount of significant damage. And also Sean O'Malley didn't back away the entire time. He did back away some of the fight, but in each round, he did take the initiative at points of the round. Not the entire round, but what I mean by taking the initiative was he would land a damaging shot, and then he would start pursuing. Peter Yan. So he also on bottom, he was also attacking from bottom position. So he got taken down, but he was shooting arm bars and triangles. The end of the third round, had, Sean O'Malley in a shooting an arm bar, as it ended. So, he was being busy even when he was on bottom. And again, it was a split decision. I could have seen that fight going either way. I can understand how somebody would believe Peter Yan won that fight. I could also understand how somebody would think that Sean O'Malley won the fight. And the same thing with Strickland Du Plessis. I could see it either way, but they were not the same type of fight. It was significantly different for how the judges are watching it and how they're moving. I don't think Sean O'Malley hit any takedowns. That was similar to, I don't think he hit any takedowns, but his attacks were much more varied. He was throwing way more power strikes than Sean Strickland. Really, I think Sean Strickland, the reason why he lost the decision, the simplest way is he, majority of his strikes were jabs, and he was backing away. So, or he was getting pressured. So, Dricus was throwing power strikes, landing takedowns, attempting takedowns, and forward pressure for five rounds. And that is one of the easiest to sum this whole thing up. Whenever you see that there in the UFC, there is a very high probability that that fighter is the one that's going to get the nod. You know, if they get wobbled in round two or three or something like that in the middle of the fight, then that is not the case. But if neither person gets dropped or wobbled really bad, look for the person who's throwing power strikes, varying their strikes and forward pressure to get the decision all of the time, or almost all the time it happens. Let's see. Already went over the Peter Yan. Those are just my notes on that. So, I hope this helped with judging perspective. It might have just confused you more, but judging in MMA is very difficult. It's not objective, it's subjective. They have rules or heuristic rules. It's not a perfect system. They do update it sometimes. I've, even with the really, really bad calls, the really horrendous decisions, I can't think of a time that they've come back and said that they were wrong about it. They usually, the athletic commission, the referees, the judges, even when the fighters protested, or they go through the correct channels of protesting decision, not protesting decision, but there's a channel that you can go through where you can actually apply to have it revisited. But I've never seen them overturn, or at least I can't think of right now where they overturn one of their decisions. That I can remember. But in closing, we had a new breed tournament yesterday. We had a good turnout. We had a lot of kids. They destroyed it. They tore it up. We had several adults that went and competed. We had a good day. We had a lot of wins. We had some losses. I'd say tournament, we had a lot of people with this tournament that it was their first tournament they did. So congratulations for doing your first one. It will get, this gets better and better. You're going to suffer some losses, especially your first, you're going to suffer the majority of your losses at the beginning of your competition career. You'll get more and more wins the more you go as you get more experience. I'd say tournament standout would have to be Lavencio. Lavencio, I believe, went 5-1 on the day, or 6-1 on the day. He submitted both of his opponents in his Nogi division. He won his Nogi division. I don't think he got a point scored on him. Submitted both of his opponents. And then his Nogi division, his Gi division, he lost in the finals by an armbar against an opponent that had a really good guard. But Lavencio is still very, very new to jiu-jitsu, but did really well. And we had several people that did really good, especially as a first time competing. A lot of nerves and stress, but, I think Brandon was telling me about before the tournament how he's like nervous and, his the jitters or the nerves before competing for his first tournament. And then his first round, his first match, he went out, I think he won 16-0. And then after the match, I said, it's funny, right? But no reason to be nervous. But that is part of the game. It never completely goes away, but you will eventually get used to it. It's gone away with me a handful of times, but to tell you the truth, every time that my nerves have been extremely low and I'm too calm, I don't perform my best. I think the nerves actually make your reactions better and your timing better. If you're in a life and death situation, you wouldn't want to be completely flat-footed and like you're asleep. You need your nervous system needs to be keyed up, But yeah, it was a good weekend. And coming up, we got Fight to Win. Right now, I know we got Kale has a matchup, so he's going to be on the Fight to Win event. That's a really cool jiu-jitsu event that you can go to. It's going to be in Murfreesboro. You can get spectator tickets, get your tickets through Kale. I know we have Kale that's doing it and Alex DeRiggy that's doing it. Kale has an opponent. I don't think Alex has an opponent yet, but hopefully we can get him an opponent before. Hopefully they can get him an opponent before the end of the week. And that'll be coming up February 2nd. So cool stuff. And then we got Memphis Open next weekend, West Coast Trials. I know Kel's doing that. We also have a Gogi in March. So busy schedule and towards the end of winter. But spring, it's going to be busy competition season again. And if you never compete and you're just doing this for fun because you enjoy it as a fan, thanks for training and thanks for working with everybody that's competing. And you don't have to do this boring stuff. If you listen to all this and you're like, yeah, that sounds like a job, like a chore, I don't blame you. It really is. It's more fun to watch a UFC fight, drink some beer, watch the fight, but just hopefully giving you information from my experience so that whenever you see these decisions and they seem like they're a robbery or something, that maybe still won't like the result, but maybe understand a little bit more. But hope you got something from this episode, and I'll see everybody next week.